Step into a world where conversations spark change, where voices of innovation inspire inclusion, where transformative ideas take center stage. A journey to explore the power of collaboration and creativity. A movement to promote more inclusive social and economic development across the Americas. All of this and more today with A Word of Trust, a podcast by The Trust for the Americas.
Hi, Aspen. Welcome to our podcast with The Trust for the Americas. Thank you for accepting our invitation, and we're very happy to have you here.
I'm so excited to join the conversation.
Awesome. So first, I'll say a little bit about who we are at The Trust for the Americas and what we do. So if there is anyone new listening to the podcast, they can hear a little of our work and our focus. So The Trust for the Americas is an organization affiliated to the Organization of American States, and it's headquartered in Washington, D.C. Our mission is rooted in promoting social and economic inclusion using technology as a cross-cutting tool. And we believe in the power of collaboration and work through partnerships with national and local governments, the private sector, and local partners. Over the past two decades, the Trust for the Americas has made a significant impact in reaching out to positive governments affecting the lives of over 5 million people. And our efforts have extended through a network of almost 400 technology training centers, innovation labs, and more than 1,000 local organizations across these countries. And also, the Trust specializes in skilling for the future of work and promoting innovation. We are dedicated to teaching vulnerable populations how to use AI tools and understand how these tools work also, to prepare them for the future of job and so that they can improve their lives and the condition of their communities. So yeah, our initiative extends to preparing individuals for employment in green industries and assisting and establishing a strength partnerships so that they can also build their entrepreneurial projects. So yeah, it's very wide, as you can see, Aspen. Well, this is what we do, and we thought that you could bring a lot of value to the conversation on artificial intelligence and these technologies and their transformative power for the lives of people. So, Aspen, why don't we begin with you telling us a little bit about who Aspen is beyond the professional image that we have, and tell us about your hobbies, things that you like to do, any personal interests.
Sure. Well, it's such a broad question, in that I have too many interests. I think, you know, so I'm a PhD student, which means I have relatively little time, and I have too many interests, which means I switch between things I like with frequency. But the balance that I've tried to emulate in my life is something physical. So something that gets me outside or it gets me moving so that I stay sane in my everyday. And that has largely fallen into running or swimming.
Awesome.
And I'm a huge fan of soccer or football. I like playing it. I played when I was younger. I don't play as much now because I've torn an ACL and I'm scared of tearing it again. And I love hiking. So, and then outside of that, the second kind of area that I think is really healthy to explore is something that gives you catharsis and creativity, which is to me everything from I will make fermented things like kimchi or sauerkraut at home to I'll make jewelry or paint.
Awesome.
So I think, you know, I feel like I want to make things in my daily life so that I feel like I'm being productive, but I also don't want to feel productive. I don't want to feel like I have to be productive. So I'm constantly trying to balance these needs.
I get you. You sound like a person that does, what is the name? I think they have a term that is like active resting. Like you don't actually rest, but you have to like switch between activities and then that's like resting.
No, I definitely am bimodal. So I will either be very active for a period of time, or I collapse and I just sleep on my couch or in my bed for days at a time. And this is how I function, is rest hard,
Awesome.
play hard, work hard.
Perfect of both worlds. Okay, awesome. I love how you're able to connect with things that we would think of in productivity, you know, like creativity. That's awesome that you connect with different parts of you through your hobbies. And I realized I didn't introduce you. So I mean I can say a little bit about you, but why don't you tell us a little bit of what you currently do, and then we can go deeper to what made you who
Sure.
you are
Yeah,
right now.
let me just do what I do right now. I'll give you my little spiel, which is I am a, I think, fifth year, sixth year PhD student at MIT. That means I'm working on my doctoral degree and I'm getting very near the end. And the work that I do is on AI or machine learning research, and sometimes on how humans interface with these types of systems. In the past, I've worked at Apple, doing kind of similar flavors of work. I've worked at JPL, NASA JPL, so that's kind of the Jet Propulsion Labs. I've been a venture investor because I was really excited about understanding what that looks like from that perspective. So that was a
Wow.
short stint, and I worked at a startup that focuses on mortgage refinancing. So kind of there's a little bit of breadth.
You really have a little bit of everything. Awesome.
We sprinkle around until we feel satisfied.
Yes. Well, awesome, Aspen. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about your how all this interest in, because I know you have a background of electrical engineering, and you just mentioned that the your interests are not just that, you know, it goes on venture, it goes on AI applied and machine learning applied to different areas. So why don't you tell us a little bit of how, where did this came from? How did it started, and how has it your interests been maturing over the years?
So I will start at the very beginning, which is the first time I was exposed to electrical engineering and computer science, which was high school. And I will tell you, I took a robotics class and I hated it, which is not un it's not because of the professor. It's just I grew up in Utah, which is a very particular place. It has kind of conservative values. Not a lot of women go into technologist positions or roles or study these types of things. And so I went into a class where it was like entirely men, and they helped me do my work. And as by helping me do my work, I did no work. I didn't really get the opportunity to learn, and I didn't really like the feeling I got in that space. And so I actually
Yeah.
decided I didn't want to do computer science at all. I went to undergrad, and in undergrad, I kind of decided to do neuroscience. So I wanted to study the brain, and I wanted to study the brain and microbiology. So I did kind of neuro research. And as part of this, I realized I actually had to learn how to code, which was very, very upsetting to me at the time. But I wanted to learn that skill set, and I hate being bad at things. So I decided to go all in. And at some point, I added computer science to the bachelor degree that I was completing. So I did neuroscience and computer science.
Wow.
And that's kind of where I started. Now, at the same time, going off of the, I have so many interests, I was doing field biology research on the Great Salt Lake, which is a really cool place for doing interesting work because it's an extremely salty environment. And the plants and animals, and more specifically the bacteria that live in that environment, are adapted to it. And so, I started doing research. I built this kind of system, this prototype system for measuring light and dark cycles for what are called stromatolites. So sometimes people refer to these as living rocks. These are just microbial mats, and they kind of capture sediment and they make rocks, okay? And
Okay.
so this is sometimes referred to as like maybe this was the origin of oxygenation and on Earth. And I built an embedded system. So this is the only electrical engineering experience I have. I built an embedded system that measured these light and dark cycles, went to a conference talking about this work. It ended up in
Wow.
me. And then I met someone who did research, computer science research, and so I ended up like going all in on computer science. And that's like the little, so I went from really, I don't like this to, okay, it's useful. I don't like it, but it's useful. And now I feel passionate about it. And sometimes I still don't like it, but I also really do enjoy certain types of that work. So.
Awesome. Okay, wow. And what specifically do you like or what interests you about computer science and machine learning research? Because you just mentioned some areas, but I know it can be very wide.
Yes, that's a really good question. So I have and always will kind of have this deep-seated interest and care for people, and how the systems, both societally and technologically, how the systems that be affect the quality of life of people, and affect how we understand the world. And so from my perspective, a lot of the research that I care about right now is on that intersection of humans and technology. So whether that's how do we think about AI, like chatbots like ChatGPT interfacing with people? How do we think about the implications that might have on elections or on XYZ? But I
Yes.
also am really curious about how do we understand these complex systems, because that affects how we use them. And so my areas of interest are, what does it mean for these systems to exist? And also, how do they work technically? So whether that's machine learning interpretability, there's a lot of work in mechanistic interpretability that I think is very exciting, to how do we kind of constrain the space of deployment so that we don't hurt people? So those are the things that I am particularly passionate about.
Yes, very complex. I was researching a little because I focus more on AI for social impact, and that's a lot of what we do also at the Trust for the Americas. And I was just seeing how it can be very complex because usually AI applied to industry is more like it's more narrow, you know, it's like a more defined task. And when you apply it to social impact, to the lives of people, then you have a lot of components and so many components and so many things, and just gets complicated. And you, if it goes wrong or if it is misused, you impact the lives of people directly. So it can be very delicate. And I love that what you mentioned about how people understand these tools, because it is something also that we look into here when we give trainings on digital skills or AI literacy. And I had seen that there is a group, the Media Lab, which is not your group, but you might know them, the Intelligent Robots group. So some. I think the researcher is Randi Williams, and she had some work on how these users, the aim is for them to be consensus users, where they can understand the impact of the technology that they are using, how it works. And th that is something very important for us in Latin America and in the Caribbean countries, so that we are not just consumers of such tools, and even to unlock the power of these tools, especially now with access to generative AI. So how can people understand these tools to really have more meaningful impact and not just stay on the surface? So, I love that. A very interesting area of focus. Do you currently work on something related to this, or what are you currently working on?
I have a couple of projects that I'm working on right now. So the most immediate project is this concept around AI supply chains or AI value chains. I can give you a 2-minute pitch on it, which is, as you just mentioned, there's all of these products that are being put into the world that we interact with. And it used to be, if you go back 5 years ago, Most of the experiences that you might have with AI or machine learning, they're all developed by the same organization, and they're developed, kind of, and evaluated and deployed by that same organization, with some exceptions. Very few, though. And now there's this growing norm of, well, one firm or organization is going to build my base foundation model, and then another one might fine-tune this model for a different task, and then I might use that fine-tuned model for another task. And so these supply chains of data sets and AI components and tools have changed the way that we understand and evaluate machine learning. So now, instead of, I can evaluate my model, and assume that my evaluations are going to hold, because I controlled this whole setting, I have to do a little bit more thinking about who and what did the efforts upstream. And the reason why this matters is because, well, you mentioned explanations. We often build, for example, explanations for a model, and that those are like local explanations. So I can spend a little bit of time explaining this, but basically we approximate the model's behavior, and that approximation works really well when you're talking about one model. But when you're talking about a couple of different models, for example, what we do with ensembling, so we have different models that kind of vote on an outcome, which is becoming more and more prevalent and popular. It's not really clear how to build an explanation that is truthful. And so we just did some work showing basically that it's possible in settings where you have these com this composition of models that the explanation will actually be not truthful at all. And that matters because there are laws in the US, for example, when it comes to financial decisions, called ECOA, this is a Equal Credit Opportunities Act, that says that organizations must provide an accurate, and detail an accurate explanation for why someone, for example, wasn't given a loan. Well, now, if these explanations might not be truthful, then can you use AI and AI supply chains in settings like finance? It's not clear to me. So you have to introduce safeguards from a regulatory perspective to ensure that people do certain types of development and certain types of methods around the explanations to ensure that they are truthful. So this is an example of the work that I'm doing now, which is when we have all of these different components mixed together, kind of like a soup, what are the implications?
Yes, awesome. And in this last example that you mentioned, I think I would highlight how you described how policy can help so that this technology is not as harmful as it would have been, or to even ask more for whoever is producing this technology. You know, like, hey, we need this set of standards for transparency, and people are they're intended to understand how it works. What makes me think from your area, because right now I guess you're more in academia, right? Because you're full with your PhD. How would you say the research can be translated into policy? How does these two work together? And especially, how do they do it in AI? Because I think it's very specific for AI.
It is, but it also in some ways isn't. I think so. I will just speak to my own experiences, which is we. In most domains, like workplace safety and food safety, we have these thresholds of, well, you can have this much rat fur in a piece in like a soup, okay? Or we have all these different safety metrics of like, if you mix two chemicals together, what are is that safe? Can they be in proximity? How far away do they have to be? And those metrics come from research. They come from people did very baseline research to understand the implications of XYZ. Similarly, and when we first invented we, the collective we, when automobiles were first introduced onto the roads, we didn't have any of the safety mechanisms that we have today. So road signs didn't really exist. The kind of agreement of stop signs and lights and, bike lanes have their own place in the world. Cars have their own place in the world. Highways, all of this didn't really exist. And so, if you look at I was looking at a video recently of like 1905, San Francisco. You see cars, bicycles, pedestrians, and horses, horse-drawn carts, along with a couple other things, all in the same area and all just going around each other. And as a result, there are these really tragic accidents that happen that were
Yes, I
like lost
imagine.
limbs or died. So, over time, we have these kind of ways of introducing safety mechanisms that the government introduces and then kind of refines. In the US, we do it reactively, or in response to a problem. But in Europe, this is more proactive. So they're usually a little bit more stringent about what things can and can't be done before they are a problem. And I actually don't know what the case, I think this is a country by country case. But what this means is it's important for technologists with AI to be doing really fundamental research on what are the implications of a setting, where do things fall apart, where do they work really well. And then it's important for sociotechnologists, so people who work both in, human computer interaction, people who are sociologists, people who have experience working with the human side of things, to think about the questions that those researchers might also want to implement and work on. So translating research into policy, that's a little bit different than what I just described, but basically I have recently experienced what it's like to talk to regulators, and it is often they are very busy and they have relatively little time. And you see people who think that they want to work in policy spaces write something like 50-page suites of notes, documentation, thoughts on a particular topic. Well, in order to translate anything into a regulatory place, you need to be able to condense that into something that is tangible and tractable. So, what are the problems? What are the questions? What are the solutions or potential solutions? All of that should be fit into a couple of pages maximum. And this is one of the ways that we can translate information legibly. So I guess to summarize this, I think as an academic, I have a tendency to write a lot, and that is not helpful. And as an individual who just wants to engage in policy work, I think, within the US, we have senators that represent us. We have House of Representatives. We have congressional hearings. We have staffers. And you can directly engage with all of these people and ask them, who is doing this work? Who should I talk to? How do I learn more? And
How do
so
you engage with them? Like, how is it done in the US?
that's a really good question. So, in the US, if you lived in a state, you can reach out to your representative and a staffer will make time for you. It's kind of one of the benefits of being represented is that you're somewhat guaranteed time. And so that's a good way to start. There's also, like I said, these open calls from NIST, from a couple of other departments where they seek out commentary from sometimes the public, sometimes from research academics. And that is a wonderful place to understand and synthesize your concerns about the world and about these problems and kind of hope to contribute to the body of work that's shaping regulation. That was a
Awesome.
long answer to what could have been a short answer.
No, it deserved to be a long answer. Thank you. Awesome. Okay. And you mentioned a word that it hasn't been mentioned in any of our podcast interviews, I am sure, which is human-computer interaction. Well, it's not just a word, but can you explain to us what is that?
Yes. So there is this really exciting. So computer science in general is a very intersectional field. It
Yes.
pulls from math, it pulls from neuroscience, it pulls from all sorts of different domains, engineering. And there is a subspace in computer science called human computer interaction. And this domain focuses on how do humans interact with technology? What are the implications of that? How do we design technology so that it is more accessible or works? Or, if you think of, here's a fun little example. If you've ever written something in a Word doc or in a Google doc and you have a little line under a word that says it's been misspelled, well, that's one of the earlier pieces of research on human computer interaction that came out, was like, how do you kind of surface when grammar, when there are errors in a document so that people can correct that. So that's a little instance, but anytime you interact with your iPhone or your Android or whatever, Samsung, I guess, whatever device you're working with, all of the experiences that you have in that phone was built by designers and researchers that think about human interaction, in very deep and thoughtful ways. So I, you know, this is, and it expands beyond this. One of my favorite spaces of work in the human computer interaction HCI field is often around museum exhibits. How do you build a museum exhibit so that someone will play with a thing and engage with it and learn from it? That often has overlap. So yeah, I think there's a little taste of it, but the field is so large that you could do everything from what I just described to smart textiles or 3D printing. Yeah, all of that falls under the HCI category.
Awesome, so interesting. Okay, so I think often in the region of Latin America and the Caribbean, we face challenges with how technology is designed, how algorithms are designed, you know, and also the resources that we have access to. Many of the challenges that organizations here face is that it seems like it is built more for English speakers. What have you seen that is happening in order to help people from non-technical backgrounds and non-English speakers to have access to these tools of artificial intelligence and yeah, to technology in general?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So a lot of initiatives are that I have seen that seem to be going well are led by a handful of, and I'm just going to focus on AI, and then I'm going to speak to, because you know, there's I think two ways to work with machine learning slash AI when you're interested in it. One is, let me use this tool for a domain or an application of interest. And the other is, let me study this tool. So the work that I have seen around trying to make these resources more accessible and to kind of expand the scope of the languages represented, for example, in large language models. I think Anthropic has done a pretty good job. I think there's a couple of nonprofits actually that focus on open model efforts. So Eleuthier AI is an example where, even though it seems like this technology is inaccessible, there's a whole open source community dedicated towards making modeling available. And that's part of, we have like an online Discord that you can join. I think Sarah Hooker, she's a researcher that I have a lot of admiration for. It sounds like you recognize her name. I think she's done a lot of good both in South America and in Africa around these kind of initiatives. And I would highly recommend people follow her Twitter, because she tweets about opportunities that pop up to join their community. I know that there are sometimes fellowships and programs that are funded directly for this, and I think that's amazing. I also, before I go too far down this route, you know, machine learning and AI is built on data, and there are individuals who do research in this space that are always seeking support from people on the ground. And an example of this would be, I think, have you might know the name Catherine D'Ignazio. So her work with data feminism is very well known. She was
Great resource.
she is a great resource. There's also I'm trying to remember. There's a professor at the University of Arizona who works on she works on indigenous data collection, and I think her work is really important. Stephanie Russo Carroll, she's She's a, I don't remember what tribe she is a member of, but she does a lot of really interesting work on that space. Catherine had a student named Harini Suresh, who is now an incoming faculty member at Brown. And so she's little tag for
What
her.
was her name?
Harini, Harini Suresh, Suresh. And Harini was really a big part of the work that Catherine did on femicides. So this work actually engaged with people on the ground who were trying to collect and understand cases of femicide, particularly in South America and Indigenous communities. And this is a very collaborative effort that's hard. And the idea here was, well, a lot of times AI does harm to communities, but it can also help us understand these cases more and make a bigger argument against and for certain types of decisions both in policing and in regulation, and just making some of these problems visible, more visible than they are. So I think these are a couple of really amazing individuals who are championing this work and who have direct relationships. Harini doesn't, but Catherine does, and Sarah does, who have direct relationships and connections to South America, and that are often very open to cold emails. They might not have time, but like, if you want to get engaged and you have a problem that you care about a lot that aligns with their interests, they are always usually open to, at the very least, making time to have a short conversation. Now,
Yes.
I don't know how many of your audience members there are, and it might be that this might be over inundating to them, but reach out to
Yeah,
them on Twitter or something like that. And there's also programs at universities individually to help students when they're applying to programs, so that they're better resourced with crafting their applications, crafting their statements to highlight their interests, so that it seems like they're a good fit for the community. So whether you're trying to get into bachelor's, master's, PhD program, whether you're trying to engage as a community member, there are tools available from everywhere, of like building a model and doing interpretability work on that model, to working with data collection, to deployment, evaluation, et cetera. So there's a lot of humans in this space now who care.
yes, and I am happy about that because you're right. Like before, I remember in 2018, something like that. I was on my first year of college, and I did a work inspired by Joy Boulan-Winnie. I presented a paper on my first conference, and it was about algorithmic bias. And I remember I was the only one who had something in the conference about like AI for something that wasn't industry. Everything was industry, and everything was man.
Yeah.
Like
Well,
just.
yeah, everything. Yeah, that's true. Especially HCI is a great community in that it's often a little bit more gender proportional. And there's a lot of queer representation as well.
Awesome.
But if you go to NeurIPS, if you go to ICML, if you go to iClear, so I'm just describing conferences that are machine learning conferences, the big
Very
three.
accessible conferences.
They are not accessible, and
Yes.
there are not very
So
many.
hard to go.
Yeah, they're expensive. They're extremely expensive, although there are grant processes. But they're extremely expensive, and they're like communities of people who are so smart but don't always know how to translate their work into something that's intelligible for the average reader or the average learner. And they are mostly men. So
Yes.
yeah, and I personally love working with women. And I like working with men sometimes. But
Depends.
It depends.
Yes.
It really depends.
But I love how you're mentioning so many great resources. So, like, whoever listens to this episode is going to be able to Google a bunch of stuff because you're just like throwing names at us and very awesome references. Which is great because we don't often they don't often get that much spotlight, and they don't get that much diffusion. Usually people think about AI and they are like the big companies, just big tech, and then it's not what we want AI to be like, I think so. So yeah, in order to have a more diverse and more rich space. But yeah, I was actually able to meet Sarah Hooker this year at a conference in Ecuador. And it was a regional conference. I'm definitely gonna invite you to more of our regional conferences because you've been mentioning a lot of interest in the AI field for something beyond the US. You know, I think you have that interest ignited in you.
Well,
So,
it's important. The US is like one part of a globe, and
yes.
so for was it ICML? No, iClear. iClear, context for everyone listening. iClear is a very large machine learning conference, and last year it was hosted in Rwanda. This was with the intention of kind of building a community in Africa around access to the best researchers in the world on this topic, right? I think that this is an agenda that needs to be perpetuated and continued because there are brilliant people everywhere,
Yes.
who just need the first connection, the first like conversation point, the first person to talk to, and the
Yes.
first like access, you know, because ultimately a lot of the times it's easier to talk to someone in person than it is to hope that your email that you send from way back when we'll connect to them. Like everyone's busy, so yeah,
Yes.
I'm a huge fan of
Reaching
building.
out.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually followed your advice because you had an interview for your group at your PhD, and I remember you said you gave an advice. You can say it again so that someone else listens to the advice. It was something between the lines of have interesting conversations with people that you admire or inspire you. Invite them to
Oh,
have a conversation with you.
yes. Okay, so I, and I'm sure everyone that is listening is often, I am often intimidated by people whose work I admire. And I have learned over time that the most interesting people to work with and learn from, if they, okay, so there's two parts to this. I don't remember what I said exactly at the time, but first of all, if you're going to work with someone and it's going to be fun to work with them and they are going to be nice to work with, they will be that way when you interact with them, regardless of your level of experience and expertise. Like there shouldn't be such a barrier to entry, I think, when talking to experts. And I also think in general, just being, you know, the cold email works really well. Like that's kind of why we are talking now, is because you reached out to me and we had like a connection and we chatted from there. So many people don't realize how just like that first point of contact it can shape your world, and can shape your interests. And I am truly a believer of, you know, be humble, be considerate of people's time, but like share your excitement. And people will respond to that. So, yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Is that what I
Awesome.
said? Maybe you should tell me what I said.
Yes, you said exactly that. I have it here. No,
Amazing.
just kidding,
Glad I'm
but
internally consistent.
but I did follow your advice, and that's why I invited you. So I know that you're interested in AI trustworthiness, transparency, and I also know that the AI machine learning spectrum is very wide and there are many challenges. Which of these many challenges that there are in the field, or which of these questions keep you up at night? Like, what are your main interests in the challenges that we have in the field right now?
Oh my.
I just opened the Pandora box, or what?
Yeah, let's see. My prior work has been kind of on interpretability, and on how do we build iterative tooling around data collection that takes into account a model so that you kind of curate your data sets to reduce poor performance for certain marginalized communities or subpopulations. So I think I'll just give you like a list of five things that I think are important. And this is not comprehensive. So the first is fairness. This is kind of a big umbrella term. People use it in a lot of different contexts. There are like theoretical definitions of fairness. Sometimes people use individual fairness or group fairness, and it's just a way of saying, well, is one group treated differently than another? Is one individual treated the way they shouldn't be? And that is not always as seamless as we'd hope it would be. A lot of times fairness depends on context. It depends on who is being harmed by the system and what those harms look like. And you might have to do a little bit more digging to understand in practice what that means to be unfair. So fairness is one. Interpretability, I said I was already interested in this. I continue to be interested in it. There's a space of work called robustness or distribution shift. Robustness and distribution shift are a little different. But basically, the idea is we often build systems for a slice of time and for a slice of the world, and that is very small. And so there are things where something changes, time passes, and maybe the language that we use changes, or the things that we care about, they change. And machine learning models, in order to compensate for that, are often kind of they have to, sometimes people do what's called RLHF, so reinforcement learning with human feedback. That's one way that we can kind of keep things actively learning, but that also has its own problems. So there's this, and then privacy. I'm sure you've heard some of these th this issue this issue in general, which is large language models and models in general sometimes memorize things, and that memorization can be regurgitated in settings that we don't want it to be. And so I really care about how to reduce that likelihood. And on a more principled note, what does it mean to be memorized, for data to be memorized, for patterns to be memorized? Sometimes this is necessary. And so there's like a balance between accuracy, like performance on everything, right? Versus robustness, which means like you're generally going to do okay. And when things change, you'll still do okay. And so there's a trade-off, and these axes are kind of trade-offs of each other. And so I think that's a really interesting space. And then finally, and I mentioned the AI supply chains. This is, I think, intersects with all of these problems. And finally, I really love the work that is applying machine learning to help people specifically, not just to make things cheaper, not just to automate systems, but to help people. And so the examples I just mentioned with Catherine, in the femicide work, I think this is a really good case of that. Anything that brings people on the ground into that circle of work, that kind of lets people have a voice in development, is necessary. So those are, a couple of axes that I care about.
Awesome, thank you. Very interesting. So, yeah, just to wrap up our conversation, we talked about how it is for women to enter this field. So, which advice would you give to any young women trying to either enter this field, do a career transition, or to begin their career in this field? Do you have any advice of anything that you would say to them?
Yes, I do. I definitely do. Okay, first and foremost, I think there's this generation of women now who have been in tech for a little bit, who are amazing to work with, because it is, we just statistically we know the more women there are in an upper in upper leadership, the more women will come into a community and stay in a community, and there are reasons for that. So if you are a woman and you are seeking collaborations, or you're seeking resources, or you're seeking advice, find another woman who's older and established and ask her. I also think that, I mentioned this case where I took a class in high school, and I worked in a way that didn't force me to learn. It is important that, and I have that is an experience that I know has been shared with many other women that I love and care for and have respect for, that happen to have learned in an environment where the culture kind of implies that women shouldn't be doing this work. So if you are in an environment like that, that's kind of not, there's not as many women doing this kind of labor, I highly suggest finding a small project and working on that on your own or with other people who have a similar amount of experience. So that gives you the time and space to develop your interests and skill set away from pressures to just let someone else do the work and away from pressures of you don't feel like you're the expert in this space because you have to have opportunities to learn on your own in order to do well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think the last thing I will say is reading about kind of people that are inspiring in this space can be very helpful because you once you have an example, it's easier to feel like something is approachable for you, like it is achievable. So
Yes.
I mean, there's so many resources in the world. I think that I can only do a little bit of justice, but I hope that was helpful for anyone listening.
Yes, definitely. Reading and having conversations, right, with inspiring women. And for
Yeah.
reading, I would recommend the latest book of Joy Boulan-Winning, because she sort of like takes you through her whole career, and I think that is very helpful, because then you can visualize, okay, so it is possible, and it happened like this for her, and this is what she went through. Very interesting.
Yeah. The other thing, yeah, that's a wonderful resource. The other thing I was going to say, and I've been seeing this with some of my family members, is we will you when you do a thing for long enough, it feels like you can't change the thing, right? If I had gone in a different route and had studied philosophy, maybe now I would feel it is impossible for me to code. And that is so not true. That like really, really, it's not. And I want to encourage people who might be listening to this that, you know, just take a little step in faith, a blind step, and don't feel bad about failing. And that is the best way for you to eventually build the repertoire of expertise that you are the expert in the room. And that takes a lot of putting aside your ego and not getting hurt when people say negative things, and just growing. So.
Yes, and especially with those career transitions, I think, because many women from the social impact sectors have reached out to me because they want to learn some technical skills and how to use data, how to use AI tools. And I think they often fall into this fallacy of like canceling all their career history, like all they've done
Yeah.
until this point, and then be like, oh, I would start from zero. And I'm like, no, you have so many years working with migrants. Like, that's amazing. Imagine, like, just combine it with AI, and you won't need to be the most technical person. You won't need to be a professor in AI, and you'll be able to do amazing things.
Yeah, truly, truly, truly. There's so much domain expertise that you gather from your life and then bring it into this new place. I think that's necessary and important. So it's so cool. I love that you have those relationships.
Well, awesome. Thank you, Aspen. Yeah, it's been an amazing conversation, and I'm sure many people will take many, many reference names and conferences and many strings to pull from. And it's been very interesting. Thank you for sharing with us all these knowledges, expertise, and for opening to tell us about your experiences and your perspectives on the world and how AI should look like.
Thank you for giving me the time. I've had so much fun chatting with you.
A Word of Trust podcast by the Trust for the Americas comes to you thanks to the production by Isabella León and Laura Rubio, and the general coordination by Carlos Escalante.